Today at Reader's Corner, historian and professor Stephanie Kuntz, author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Looking at the past through rose-colored glasses is nothing new. We've been doing it in various forms for centuries. But when it comes to family life, that yearning for a simpler, happier time can be particularly potent. Mid-century television shows such as Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet celebrated the nuclear family, where Dad was the breadwinner, Mom managed the house and kids, and everything seemed to run smoothly. But was life really so great back then, or was this simply an illusion? In the new edition of her acclaimed 1992 book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, historian Stephanie Kuntz exposes the myths that define our ideas of traditional American family life, both past and present. Professor Kuntz teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and is the director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. She visited Boise State University in March to present a lecture sponsored by our School of Public Service, and she joins us today by Skype for this interview. Stephanie Kuntz, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie, let's start with your subtitle. What is the nostalgia trap that, again, seems to work its way throughout your book when it comes to better understanding who we really were?
Well, you know, it's funny. Nostalgia is a very natural human emotion. And in personal life, it's not bad at all. I mean, how many women would ever have a second child if they didn't kind of forget the pain of childbirth or the vacations? You forget the fights in the car, and that's right. Why you're willing to go on a new one. The problem is that when nostalgia, there's an interesting distinction between personal nostalgia, which is the desire to recapture a feeling, and political or social nostalgia, which is the illusion that everybody had the good feelings all the time, and that you could recapture those good feelings if you tried to turn the clock back. And that, I think, is the problem when we look back at family life. You know, you mentioned the 1950s family. You know, I understand why some people might feel nostalgic for some parts of that. I mean, this was a period right after World War II when the economy was booming, social and economic inequality was decreasing rather than increasing. Working class Americans, even without a college education, were getting the lion's share of back in wages of what they produced. But of course, there were some real problems in thinking that this was because the families were all better. For one thing, Black and Native American families were left out of this prosperity. But even white families had lots of problems in those days. This was a period where if you were a woman, your only access to the post-war prosperity was to marry a man who would support you. And you had to do that and put up with quite a bit. You know, this was a period when domestic violence was not taken seriously. It was much higher and more widespread than it is today. When the legal definition of rape was forcible intercourse with someone other than your wife. When women couldn't even take out credit cards in their own name. Infanticide was higher in the 1950s than it is today. Child abuse was higher. So yeah, if you lived in a family that was white and the man had a good job and was willing to share his resources and did not take advantages of the social and legal privileges, I can understand why you might say, well, that was pretty good. But not everybody lived that way. And it turns out that even people who were in fairly decent families, when I interviewed women who lived in 1950s families and marriages, even the ones who had decent marriages said that they were just frustrated by the extent to which they were confined to the home. And sometimes their husbands would sit down and actually weep about the extent to which the gender stereotypes of the era made them strangers to their own children and family.
And I think somewhere in your book, you actually talk about the fact that there are some who would like to think that this nuclear family is still with us to a large degree, and that to a large extent that works against dealing with the public policy issues that arise from the fact that there's too many families that aren't nuclear, too many children in poverty, too many children that need help. And it doesn't help when you have this kind of rose-colored blinder on that gives you a distorted view of who we really are.
Well, that's the thing, and it's so important. I think, you know, most people, when they think about the traditional family, think about a small nuclear family with the man as breadwinner. But, you know, the male breadwinner family is arguably the least traditional family in all of history. Through most of history, it was not expected that a man would go out to work and bring home the wages, and his wife would stay home and just take care of the home and the children. You know, in colonial days and in 19th century America, the majority of women either worked beside their husband on a farm or in a small business. The children went out to work. It wasn't until the 1920s that a small minority of kids were able to stay home with a mom who wasn't working for wages outside the home or directly on the farm, and they being taken care of by someone else. And that receded in the Depression and World War II, roared back during the 1950s, but is now gone again. And, you know, it's just not going to come back, both because of economic need for two-income families, but also because increasingly modern families, the men want to share family life more than they were allowed to under the male breadwinner regime, and the women want to be more involved in work. And so we have a situation now where there's no such thing as the normal family. There are more children being raised by single mothers than by stay-at-home married mothers. And although that poses some challenges, one interesting thing is that both working mothers, employed mothers, and single mothers actually spend more time interacting with their kids today than married stay-at-home mothers did in the 1950s and early 60s.
Now, that's a piece that I was really surprised to hear because, of course, the conventional wisdom is just the opposite of that. And yet your research shows, as you just said, that women are spending more time.
Well, they are. And, of course, fathers have tripled the amount of child care that they spend. You could have counted it in minutes back in the 1950s and 60s. And we did count it in minutes when we did time use diaries. Now, there was more availability. One of the things that is a real serious problem with today's workforce participation is that our school schedules and work schedules and policies are still organized on the assumption, the very rare assumption, that every family has a wife at home to take care of the kids when they get out of school at 3 and to take care of the rest of life. So it is true that in the 50s, there were more women available to their kids, even if they weren't interacting with them. But I think the solution to the problems for today is to move forward into the 21st century, not to look back to the 1950s, to develop the kind of work-family policies, to rethink our school schedules that will allow both men and women to combine work and family life.
Mm-hmm. You know, Shania Twain had a song called Honey, I'm Home. And it really, what I thought it did anyway, was kind of satirical, made fun of the fact that the woman has to come home and then start all over again, a second job at home after working all day someplace else. And she makes fun of that by having her husband or her live-in, whoever it is, run around doing all these things like putting her feet up and getting her a beer and all this other stuff. And when I read your book, I read a line you said, "Time to retire the claim that most wives employed outside the house have to work a second shift when they get home," which was, again, what Shania Twain was having fun with. But you're talking here about a mythbuster, I guess you could say.
Yes. I mean, I like to be an equal opportunity mythbuster, to bust conservative and liberal myths about the family. And this is a feminist myth that it is time to retire, that women who work do a second shift when they come home from work. They do more, especially with young children. They, on average, put in more work hours than their husbands, even when they work equal work hours, when the children are very, very young. But it's certainly nothing like a whole second shift, another 8-hour day. And as the kids get older, it evens out very much. I mean, one of the good news stories of all the changes that we've seen, whatever their challenges, has been that men have increasingly begun to step up to the plate in terms of doing more child care, doing more housework, and sharing the load. And it turns out that this is really good for families. One of my favorite pieces of research done by Amanda Miller and Dan Carlson, who've been studying families formed since the 1990s, and they find that that in contradiction to the way things were in the past, when couples who clung to a traditional division of labor in the home tended to report higher marital satisfaction and sexual satisfaction, today it's the opposite, that the couples who share housework and childcare the most equally report the highest marital satisfaction, the highest sexual satisfaction, and they're the only couples who are having more sex than ones in the past. I have this friend of mine who says, yes, I knew that all the time. It's called chornography.
That's great. So another one of the myths is self-reliance. We always stood on our own two feet. And if whether it's the Leave It to Beaver household or the Ozzie and Harriet household, they look like they're doing it all by themselves. You kind of take this apart and in two ways. First of all, you deal with the Frontier family. Let's start there. Just how independent and self-reliant was the Frontier family?
Well, you know, I think it's in a neck and neck race with the 1950s family as the family that got the most support. After all, when we settled the West, it wasn't just individuals going out and do it. Those were the loners and the misfits who had almost always failed. After all, that was dependent on huge federal land grants, government-funded military mobilizations against the original Indian and Mexican inhabitants, state-sponsored economic investments, the Homestead Act of 1862, something that we in the West should be familiar with, that allowed settlers to buy 160 acres for $10. That was far below the government's cost of acquiring the land. And so there was tremendous investment in Western exploration and development, communication systems. Remember the Pony Express, remember the railroads. The Pacific Railroad Act was funded by the government. Every mile of rail the railroad companies built, they got 12,800 acres of the land that that acquired with all the rights to the coal and the land that they contained. Then it was essential for people to cooperate in community efforts, from barn raisings to everything like that. And then in the 20th century, a new form of public assistance became absolutely essential to the Western development, and that's the construction of dams and other federally subsidized irrigation projects. You know, we wouldn't have the New Deal. The New Deal brought us pumps, refrigeration, household technology to thousands of families who couldn't have bought them on a market that didn't even exist. So the Western development and the strength of the Western family depended really, really importantly on government insistence and on community cooperation, both together.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Stephanie Kuntz, author of The Way We Never Were. And of course, the 50s, you alluded to the 50s, but obviously the escape or the rush to the suburbs, buying of homes. I mean, you didn't buy those homes without a little bit of help from the federal government, correct?
No, that's why I say the 1950s is a good candidate to outweigh the Western one in terms of the support it had. First of all, you had a whole generation of young men getting veterans benefits, and that was available to 40% of the male population between ages 20 and 24, and that paid for a whole generation of men to expand their education and improve their job prospects. Then you have the Eisenhower's highway building project, again, a federal investment in this whole road system that created new jobs and also opened up suburbia to people looking for new houses. And all of the government-funded research that prefabricated clapboards, walls and ceilings, aluminum clapboards, the technological basis of the post-war housing revolution actually had its roots in government funding of the military that was then turned over to private development. And then the government stepped in and reorganized the mortgage system, which used to require like 50% down and only allowed people to have 5 to 10 years to pay it off. The government got into the business of insuring single home construction. And so this was a tremendously important federal funding. And contrary to the myth, once you get government stepping in to provide the stepping stone for people, then they do much better building on that start and actually supporting themselves. So this idea that somehow government funding is always bad for people's initiative and independence does not fit in with our historical experience at all.
Let's talk a little bit about your students today, my students here at Boise State. When you ask your students to write down their ideas of what a traditional family is, what do they come up with today?
Well, it's funny because even though very few of them live in a traditional family, almost none of them live in what we wrongly think of, as I said, as a traditional family, they tend to still use that as a touchstone for what the traditional family used to look like. And even if they're very happy with their own family, there is this sense, this Leave It to Beaver sense that, oh gosh, you know, maybe if we lived like that, we'd be even happier. So one of my favorite comments from one of my students, she wrote an essay and she said, people nowadays don't respect the marriage vowels. She meant vows, but I thought it was actually a nice mistake because it could be like IOU. The problem, of course, is that the traditional marriage, if you go way back, was not based upon love and romance at all, and it certainly wasn't based upon mutuality between men and women. It wasn't until the late 18th century that people began to marry for love and for individual choice rather than for political and economic convenience and to carry out parents' wishes. And it wasn't until the 1970s that we began to repeal the head and master laws that said that a woman that everything a woman brought with her to marriage was basically her husband's, that he had the right to make all the final decisions in the household. And as I said earlier, the idea of the male breadwinner family, that was also very, very non-traditional. But these ideas have become such an important part of our American mythology that many people feel themselves somehow lacking if they can't live up to it. And that's why I think it's so important to have a good, honest conversation about what the strengths and weaknesses were of the very many different family forms that we have seen throughout American history and throughout the history of the world.
You know, when we talk about the traditional family or lack thereof in the 21st century, I can't help think of the fact that Idaho is one of five states that does not have pre-K public schooling. And we're working on that. But again, most of the opposition seems to come from legislators who think this is something parents should be doing at home, given all the free time they have. I wonder if you could comment on that in terms of the challenge it presents when people just don't understand what kind of, quote, family they're talking about these days.
Well, I think it's just tremendously sad that people are taking this approach. First of all, for one thing, many women are in the workforce. For another thing, many of the kinds of ways that kids need to be prepared for a new schooling system involves their being interacting with other kids, getting some sorts of experiences that are very difficult to provide in the home, even if you do have a full-time parent at home. And we see throughout the industrialized West that countries that have invested in preschool education, their kids are doing better in school. The learning gap between rich and poor, rural and urban, is declining. But, you know, and it's particularly ironic that when this happens in the West, because the Northwest Ordinance, adopted in 1787, argued that education was key to the arrangements of the new region, that schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged, said the Act. And they set land aside in every township for a public school. And at this point in history, we should also be setting that site aside for preschool as well.
So you wrote an epilogue to the paperback edition of the book that came out in 2016, and it's a long epilogue because, of course, you're trying to sum up all that's changed since the early 1990s edition of this book. And I think there's any number of things we can talk about here, but I know one of them is simply if you could address the two powerful shifts that you say have occurred, changing the topography of family over the past half century.
Yes, you know, it's so interesting because there are two very different trends, both of which are very powerful despite ups and downs in them. One of these movements that we see beneath the surface of America is the increasing belief. And I say this in spite of the fact that we've had some setbacks recently in terms of the revival of open racism. But there's increasingly a sense that people should not be categorized by their race or their gender or their sexuality, that every individual has a right to equal treatment. And that belief has grown very strong. It is stronger in many ways than it's ever been. You see it particularly in male-female relations, for example. There's really more acceptance of women. Now, you've got the Me Too movement that shows we still have a long way to go. But believe me, under the surface in the 1950s, it was a lot worse than it is today. We've made tremendous progress. At the same time, though, as we have made this progress toward accepting the need for interpersonal equality, we've in many ways fallen back in our acceptance of socioeconomic inequality. You know, from World War II to the 1970s, every generation of young working men earned three times as much in constant dollars as their father did. And 70% to 90% of all income growth in periods of economic expansion went to the bottom 90% of the population. That has been reversed since really 1980, with the exception of a boom period from 1996 to 2000. Every generation of young men has earned less on average than their fathers have. And the majority of income in every period of expansion has gone to the top 10%, and especially the top 1% of the population. The clash between the growing inequality and with it insecurity, because we're seeing it's not just inequality, but insecurity of jobs and wages and volatility of those wages, that is rubbing against our abstract belief in the equality of men and women. And it's really unclear where we're going to go with this. Will this lead to more fear and scapegoating of other people and thinking, well, I'm falling behind, and maybe it's the women, or maybe it's minorities, maybe it's blacks, maybe it's immigrants who are driving me back? Or will it lead to our saying, wait a minute, there are a few things that we could be nostalgic for about the 50s in the context of a new generation of family life, and that is that everybody, whatever their family form, whatever their education, whether they're rural, whether they work with their hands or whether they work with their heads, they should be entitled to a living wage, a certain amount of job security, a pension, and a working schedule that allows them to have dinner with whoever they count as family when they come home at night.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with writer Stephanie Kuntz, author of The Way We Never Were. The book explores the trap of viewing American families and our changing cultural norms through a lens of nostalgia. You write that America's poor aren't the only ones dependent on public support, but that middle class and affluent families have historically benefited. We talked a little bit about that. As we move into the future, what kind of government assistance is appropriate as we try to rescue the so-called non-traditional family from the challenges it currently faces?
One of the interesting ironies and very misleading ways that the United States has developed its social support system is that we give welfare, what we call welfare, to the poor in very small amounts, actually, compared to the kind of social assistance that the middle class and the affluent get. But the assistance to the middle class and the affluent is disguised, for example, in home ownership deductions, which the more you've paid for your house, the more the government is forgiving your debt. And if you owe me $100 and I forgive that debt, that's a gift to you just as surely as whether I handed you the cash. And you get all sorts of this kind of deductions for corporations, for the affluent, and even for the middle class, at the same time as we refuse to invest directly in building the sort of infrastructure, whether it's better highways, which produce jobs, new developments of technology, that actually allow people to then build their own lives independently. So in a sense, I think we've got this backwards, that we should be investing much more heavily and much more generously in education, in job creation, in social safety nets, because it turns out that when people do lose their job and then end up going tremendously into debt, it takes them much longer to come back with much greater costs to the economy in the long run than giving people unemployment insurance. So we're so afraid, unlike our forefathers. When our forefathers talked about the general welfare, welfare wasn't a dirty word to them. We've turned welfare into a dirty word, and we've ignored the extent to which we all depend upon social investment in things that allow us to do our jobs, to create new jobs, and to build family life.
When your revised and updated edition of The Way We Never Were came out, your publisher said something like, you were going to assess what family trends got right, where you missed the mark, and what you failed entirely to anticipate. Now, that's your publisher talking, so you might not want to put it as strongly. But I wonder if you could just share with us what is the most surprising thing as you look back on this book that you wrote in the 90s, and now here it is 2018, you've already discussed the income gap, and maybe that's it. The fact that, you know, 50% of the income in America is earned by 10% of the people. And obviously that kind of income inequality is devastating. Anything else?
Well, actually, that's the piece I'm proudest of in the original book. I was writing in 1992 about all of the trends that were undermining the prosperity of working class Americans and channeling our resources to the top 10% of the population, increasingly the top 1%. I had to write a new introduction to the book in 2000, and this was at the end of the 1996 to 2000 boom. And at the time, I thought, oh, this is what I really got wrong in the book, you know, because obviously we're doing just well now. Real wages have picked up again, you know, poverty has fallen. But it turns out that that four-year period was the fluke. And if you look at my chapters on the economic crisis, they are actually ring more true now than they did back in 2000. So I'm proud of that. But what I missed several things about the extent to which, for example, I totally missed the extent to which same-sex marriage would be turned around. I really thought as late as 2005, when I wrote a book on the history of marriage, I was saying that, you know, probably it would be a long, long time before America accepted same-sex marriage. So this was one of the most startling, rapid changes in popular opinion that I've ever seen as a historian. So I certainly missed that. I feel proud of the extent to which I did anticipate the progress that that men were making in the home. But again, I think that I underestimated how much was going on in some of these workplaces. And I think that good part of this is not just the sexual, it's the continued inequality at work, where women in particular just don't feel that they can get new jobs and can stand up to harassers at work. Actually, I think that I'm proudest of the fact that I took on a lot of these myths about prosperity, about self-reliance. Back in 1992, for example, they were all talking about crack babies, you know, that was the cause of poverty and dysfunction and crime in the inner cities, and that women were being put to jail for that. It turns out now that researchers have gone back and they've studied children born with cocaine in their system and found that the children born in the same kind of poverty without any drugs in their system have the same kind of deficits, that the toxin they were exposed to was poverty and neighborhood dilapidation rather than cocaine. And now here we are seeing this with the opioid addiction, which started among white people. And again, we've got to see this as a crisis of our society and the way we organize our work in our community.
Well, Stephanie, we have to wrap this up, but I'm going to use your words to give a last word to our listeners. If you believe Leave It to Beaver was a documentary, then you need to read The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, revised and updated edition by Stephanie Kuntz. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Next week, Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein, author of Janesville. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.